Hey, Ed.
Hi, Michael. How you doing?
Oh, another day in paradise.
I've always found you inspiring.
Yeah, and I feel like is it Mowgli in the Jungle Book?
Yeah.
Except I'm not afraid of the animals, it's the people I'm afraid of.
Well, that's a worthy thing to keep in mind.
Yeah. I mean, I love them a lot, but man, Jesus.
Yeah.
So how's sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, I have to ask, how's the weather your way?
actually, we've got what the Germans call a golden October.
Oh, yeah?
So yesterday it was 25 degrees centigrade, which is about 78 degrees Fahrenheit, I guess, somewhere around there, almost 80 degrees.
So does that translate to Indian summer here in Southern California?
Yes, they call it old wives summer here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we called it Indian summer back in Pennsylvania as well.
Yeah, okay.
And in Bad Hersfeld, the city near where I live, they have the oldest Volksfest in all of Germany. It's been... Yeah, it's been running since 832.
Uh-huh.
They have it every year, and it started yesterday. Yesterday was the kickoff, and they light a huge bonfire at precisely noon on Monday.
And the fire
has to burn continuously until 6 p.m. on Thursday when it's put out.
Wow.
And if for any reason the fire doesn't go on or it goes out beforehand, then the festival will move to... a Fulda, which is a city south of here, but it's left. Yeah. It's we've got a lot of tradition. So I was up there with my grandson yesterday for a couple of hours to go on the rides and see what was going on. Get something.
Oh, that was that fun for you?
It's fun for me. Yeah, I love spending time with the little guy. He teaches me a lot every day.
I hear you. I think that's very true.
He's my current mentor.
Yep. Yep. Very much they are. When I look in the eyes of the child, I'm feeling my own child inside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can almost remember what it was like. It's been so long.
Yeah, you can almost, but when they get you to laughing, I think you do feel it. You may not remember it, but it's a memory of feeling more than anything else.
It certainly is.
You know, that's why one of my favorite things from Jesus is telling, and I'm paraphrasing, hey, you need to have the eyes of a child.
Yeah. Kids get it. Yeah. Okay. Doug said he was going to show up.
Good.
Hello, gentlemen. Hello, Marco. Hi, Doug.
Hello.
Okay. Hi, everybody.
Hey, John's back. Hi, John.
Hello. I have a different technological setup right now because my computer is in the midst of some kind of crash and this. It's not its fault. I upgraded the operating system kind of on a whim when I should have given it a window of time when I could deal with issues. But I decided for some reason to do it like on Friday. I wanted to get things upgraded in general, you know? But it totally went wrong because after the upgrade, I could not open Safari. I could not use it at all, basically. So I'm on another device right now. And I'm going to have to reorient to speaking to people in little boxes. We've actually had face-to-face in-person time.
Is there a way we can switch it back? I mean, these composite faces?
You can do that on your end.
Because that starts to give me visual problems because my back is hurting because I'm looking into the screen so much it's throwing my neck out. I like seeing a whole face while they're talking rather than seeing 10 faces simultaneously. Some of them are getting up and going to the bathroom and coming back or brushing their teeth. It's like a whole different world that I don't like. Especially as people are so interesting, their faces while they're talking, you pick up on very subtle.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
In their voice. Mm-hmm. It's so much more important to me than seeing 10 faces in little boxes all at the same time. This, I don't know, I haven't read any studies on this, but I'm sure this is fucking up our brains.
Well, not only, John, but also.
It's certainly fucking up my brain. I'll speak for myself.
No, I'm with you there.
I was wondering why the back of my neck was hurting so much. And I realized my posture is, since I spent so much time.
Oh, okay. See, and I thought it was just because we're all pains in your neck.
That.
Technically, there is a way to do that. And on your end, John, you should be able to. There's a little button on your. It should be on maybe upper right of your screen, which allows you to switch to a speaker view. There are two views, gallery and speaker. So if you switch to speaker view, then you'll see me talking right now.
Okay, cool. Okay, I see you now. See you now. Yeah. Oh, I see gallery view. Okay.
That's it.
Yeah, that helps a lot. Okay, cool.
Okay. I think here we all are. Doug, how are you?
I'm doing all right.
Well, what would you like to talk about? We did I'm just coming off of the GEPSER conference, which took place in Boulder. Today is October, 15th? And that was 11, 12, 13th. And I had, the experience of going to the conference, which this was my experience, is like a series of encounters or a series of conversations, not all of which linearly line up as a logical progression, but kind of have this mutational quality that GEPSER describes. And I felt like it was a special occasion because of the people who were coming together. And because you don't, I think you rarely in real life, so to speak, get to have that kind of face time with people in that kind of context, having those kinds of conversations, and not just conversations, but also the shared experience of being there and being in that particular place. It seemed significant, and it was significant, that the event was held at Naropa University, which, as the theme of the conference, had to do with the meeting of East and West in Gebser's thought. Although not all the presentations directly related to that, but that being a theme. Naropa provided a context where that actually happened in the work of Chagnyam Trungpa Rinpoche and all the various teachers and artists and poets that he attracted there, including, I think, Ken Wilber, who was partly attracted to this area because of the presence of Naropa and had been reading Trungpa's work and influenced by his teachings. So it was a wonderful time. Jeffrey and Heather and I did a presentation on Sunday on the quantum and field poetics, which we rehearsed for last week. And I had a number of other interesting conversations and experiences. There was time outside, there was time for dialogue, for open dialogue, and there were intellectual presentations and ideas. And I think interesting lines of inquiry opened up. And overall, it was this wonderful group of people, and I enjoyed it. And I'm recalibrating myself now, coming off of that experience and the kind of stress that I felt leading into it because of the presentation and also a poetry reading, a poetry gathering that we organized for the Saturday night of the conference, which was a kind of thing unto itself. I don't even know if I would want to talk about that today. But it was, for me personally, it was a bit of a convergence, and I had to really focus on it. And I had some sleepless nights leading up to it as I was trying to write and think things through and organize, my my contribution to the event. And so I don't fully have it all parsed out or figured out or have a clean narrative about what happened. And whatever narrative I have is just my own. And if Jeffrey or Heather were here, they have other things to take care of, but they would certainly enrich and transform that narrative. And I think what's interesting about it is that it's a conversation that will continue to variegate, you know, as each of the individuals who came to the conference go in their separate ways, but then reconvene in these other contexts, like, you know, conference next year or some other kinds of events. So I'd love to hear what you were able to see of it, because some of these sessions were live streamed, or what bits of the conversation would be interesting to discuss. Any other way that I could be helpful in terms of reflecting or maybe transmitting some of what I may have picked up there into the space that we have here.
Thank you. I wish I could have been there. I was at the conference last year, so I resonate with that different interesting lines of inquiry opening up after the conference. So, and you mentioned the poetry gathering, and that you were reluctant to talk about that because that was something else entirely, sort of on a different wavelength, I gathered from what you said. This idea of convergence. So with all of that, what would you like to talk about about this conference? Because I'm not sure what to ask you yet.
I'm not sure either. What's funny is that after the conference, and it wasn't just the conference, it was these, like I said, the encounters and the conversations and the relationships. Like on Sunday night, I did not mention, we gathered at Caroline's house, myself, Jeffrey, and someone who, I don't think anyone here knows, Duffy, but who's friends with Caroline and lives in town. And we had a little gathering as well, which had another quality to it and had another layer, you know, of this whole convergence. So there was differentiation within the convergence. So the poetry gathering was its own kind of space, and then Caroline's house was its own kind of space. And then Naropa was its own kind of space, the event happening there. And then when I came back, when I woke up on yesterday morning, Monday morning, and it was over, I went out for a long walk. And I wore these sunglasses.
That must belong to one of your daughters.
No, I bought them because I had lost my other pair.
Oh, okay.
And I happened to be in Boulder, and you know, it is sunny here in Colorado, and I use sunglasses just as a matter of regular practice. And then I started getting an idea, and it became a kind of vision for. It became complex and it became kind of large. So I don't necessarily want to talk about this now, but the idea would be in like a droplet, a line of a designer but affordable magical cosmos sunglasses. And so this is how it would work. They would be bright like this. They would be distinctive. And then the glasses would come with questions embedded in them. Two questions, one for each lens. And then when you go for a walk on a sunny day, you'd put on the glasses and you would hold these questions as you go about wherever you're going. Not too tight, not too loose, just have them present. And these questions would be a kind of paradox, but they would be questions through which to see reality anew. And now, when you come across another person who is wearing the same brand sunglasses, which are recognizable through whatever secret means, magical sunglasses, then that becomes the opportunity and the occasion for a potential conversation about the questions that you've been holding, respectively. And so then I imagine that this could be a kind of occult movement with secret magic sunglasses that hold a question or a couple of questions such as this. One question that like kind of the baseline question we could have in one lens would be, what do we want to have happen? The other lens could be, what wants to happen? And then you could switch out perspectives. What do I want to have happen? What wants to happen? And so forth. And then there could be all kinds of questions generated, which express or engage a paradox. But it's always this stereoscopic vision. Like, it would be a kind of training in holding two things in your mind at the same time. Just like we have left brain, right brain, left hand, right hand. We play a guitar, we play a piano, we walk, we run. Everything is really in twos. And so if we can coordinate through this vision practice, this social visioning practice, a cosmic stereoscopic vision. And if these glasses were practical and stylish and affordable and fun, and open source, so people could submit their own questions, discuss them on the forum, and so forth, I thought that would be a fun business idea. And so I walked around town wearing these glasses, thinking it through and just playing with the idea. And then as I was walking, well, basically what ended up happening is I got into a couple of conversations with people, one of whom lives in town and doesn't work, is on disability, and hangs out in town, in the park, or in other places. Another of whom was transient, was passing through town, didn't have a home, and was looking for bus fare. And I ended up in these two long, very interesting conversations. The first one started out because I shared this idea of the glasses. And I think what I would like to do is write this into a piece, like a fictional piece, really, and submit that to the journal that Jeremy is putting together, the anthology called Mutations. Because I think this mutation, it's just a crazy idea, right? I think it sort of really was sparked by this convergence, and not just the convergence by itself, but everything leading into it. And so it was a very pleasant way to decompress from the conference and to relax and just have some time outside. Very low tech, don't need any kind of AI to do this. You just put on the glasses, go out and see what happens. I feel grateful that we had the chance to do it. Lisa Murawski was there, and she shared a poem with me, which I could read later. I think it's really poignant. John Dotson, Hans, who knows you, Ed. I'm blanking on his last name.
Grünich is his last name. Hans, okay. Grünich. No.
And he did a wonderful talk, a keynote on Friday night on Gebser and Asia, really tight. This is where the topic of Satori versus Samadhi comes in, yeah, which we can get to. Last thing I'll show, Donna Schill, who participated in some of the Gebser reading, shared this piece of art with me. I can explain that later. There's a story behind that as well. But does that help at all? Maybe opening up some potential topics?
Yeah, the secret magical cosmos sunglasses. and vision. And as I've resisted it, I think of vision logic, a term that we bounced around last time. I think it comes from Wilbur. And I think we also talked about Google Glasses on one of our calls. Maybe it wasn't last cafe, but so I'm just free associating. I also remember you were talking about someone else with the secret magical cosmos glasses, sunglasses coming towards you. And I just couldn't help but think about if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him.
No.
I know, it's a little morbid, but I had to get that
that's
out.
Soccer.
So I'm sharing my shadow effects with all. So those are my most interesting lines of inquiry right now. I hope that resonates with somebody on this call. And I'm perfectly happy to pass the baton to somebody else.
I'm happy too to comment on any of the particular talks that were given.
Any of them yet.
Oh, okay.
Chance. It's only Tuesday. I think they just came up yesterday.
Maybe. Yeah, he was live streaming them, some of them. It was a pretty rudimentary setup, and some things may not have been streamed. So I know a couple folks may have been following it.
Carrie Welch there?
She was.
Oh, good. I see her, hear hers especially.
I invited her to join us for a future cafe, and she read a poetry reading as well. And your talk was very interesting because it had to do with the brainwave states and the electrical signals, the beta, alpha, theta, delta, gamma, and then a theory of how those might correspond to the structures of consciousness, and then what might the integral, either frequency and or she theorized or hypothesized combination, the cord, if you will, of all of them might be integral. That was, I think, what she left us with. It was interesting.
So when the secret magical cosmos sunglasses, could you have like earbuds so that they could be binaural beats?
I started thinking.
While you're walking, they want to sit down while this is happening.
We're all getting older, so we're going to need hearing aids and things like that. We could have various lines. prescription glasses. So if you need reading glasses, we could do the frames, and then the lenses could be. Really, the possibilities are endless.
So if I understand, you were really going multi-perspectival through this whole thing.
Well, one thing that became about the sunglasses that was interesting to me, like just as a meta-theoretical mm-hmm. observation, is that you think more dimensions might be better, but maybe just the simplicity of two, and like working with dualities or working with binaries or polarities.
Yeah.
That might be as much as we can do, really, naturally. Because think about walking around with like as four quadrants or something like that. If you're going to divide things at all, a natural division would be similar to the human body. So our bodies, of course, there are all different kinds of bodies and disabilities and things like that. But in general, the pattern is we have two-ness to us.
Yeah.
And that there's a natural coordination and a rhythm there. So this is coming also from one of the sessions at the conference. It was a fellow named Glenn Perry. And he wrote a book called Original Thinking, which one of the first things I noticed when I was in the room, because the title was interesting. he has some background, some Native American background. I think Cherokee, lives in New Mexico. And he led a he led an open dialogue with, you know, the talking stick, and really a kind of he created a sacred space for dialogue, with a lot of gratitude, a lot of acknowledgement, and it was interesting because he asked two questions in the course of the dialogue. He started with one, and the first question was this. It was, what things belong together? What things belong together? And so then conversation went around, and, you know, like you could say peanut butter and jelly, but you could also say love and pain, or you can say truth and beauty. But really in the moment, it's more what's arising, and it's not abstract. But then he added another question in, and the other question had to do with time and space and how that relates to place. But what was interesting with respect to the sunglasses is that the second question didn't supersede or cancel the first, and he invited us to hold them both in the space simultaneously so that we might, or what might come through in the dialogue, could respond to either or both, and really the field, you could say, that they engendered. So I saw that connection in retrospect. So the idea came to me, the stereoscopic vision and the sort of practice of holding paradox and then engaging conversationally through paradox. But that would have been one element. That would have been like one of the genetic, you know, components of the idea. And of course, the questions, what would you like to have happen, comes from clean language. And so then that gets kind of into the stew, into the concoction. And the glasses were just, I think they were inspired by my daughters, actually. Because they
are very glamorous, I must say.
Well, I have one daughter whose favorite color is pink, and the other one is purple. And this is kind of pinkish purple. It's kind of just in between. And that's so this has become my, you know, my, the color of my soul, if you will. And it's reflective too. I like that kind of reflectiveness, because then the other sees themselves in your lens. And, you know, again, the practicality can't be overlooked, you know, with climate change and, you know, the, you know, compromise of our atmospheric protections and so forth, such glasses could be more and more useful in the future. Hi.
Who's there?
Hey there.
Greetings. Hi, Heather. Is Douglas there?
Okay. Oh, there's Heather. Yeah.
So can I ask about the presentation, since Heather's here also? Is there a, and Jeffrey was in the presentation too. I've not seen it, but I was participated in the rehearsal on the last cafe. So I would like to ask something specific about the presentation that you gave on Sunday, and what, if anything, you learned from the experience, and, you know, looking back on the performance and then looking at the cafe last Monday when you rehearsed it, were there any changes that happened in between that rehearsal and the final performance that you would like to share with us or reflect upon?
Heather, are you there?
It's an open question for either one of you or both of you.
Oh, I want to make sure she can hear, though, at least.
Hi, guys. Were you talking about me?
Did you hear the question I asked?
I didn't. I just dialed in. So.
Okay. Should I repeat that, Marco, or do you want to just go with that, or?
Well, we've been chatting for the last, I guess, 30 minutes or so, and I was giving more kind of my own subjective recount of the weekend, I was sharing an idea that I had yesterday, which had everything and nothing to do with the conference. And then you popped on and John asked about our presentation, the one you, Jeffrey, and I did.
Oh,
and,
okay.
You know, what changed about it, or you know, how did we approach it after the rehearsal that we had done last week?
Yeah. Cool. So I'll listen for a minute. I'm driving, so.
Okay, well, that's my sort of meta question, I guess, is what happens next?
Hmm.
I'm just looking at sort of the history of the transformations that have occurred in the last couple of years as we've moved from study to study group, and how do we choose what we're going to study? How do we choose what we're going to talk about from, you know, each group, each conversation at the cafe has morphed in many different directions. One of the things that we did study together was the Gidley paper on Gebser, Steiner, and Wilbur. And she referenced a lot of Aurobindo, Sri Aurobindo. And one of my motivations, and I think it was shared by others, was let's put those three together. And many of us already are pretty familiar with Wilbur, and see what happens next. And so we're already coming to the last lap, I think, of Life Divine. And my interest is in, okay, now we can, when we finish this, I think it will be a phase. We could say, okay, this is a big chunk. Within that big chunk, there are lots of little chunks. So we can chunk down and chunk slow. I got that from Kerry Welch, actually, chunking slow, or maybe it was Garfield and Welch had an interview. And that's been a rallying cry for me. Can we chunk this down? Chunk it slow. And I think in our last Aurobindo call, I invited people to look at Michael Murphy's list of metanormal capacities. And because he, in his book, The Future of the Body, he's really looking at cities, paranormal. He calls it metanormal. And how Aurobindo was very upfront about exploring these cities, which in many traditions is frowned upon, that you shouldn't get into these cities at all. And so that's what interests me, because I don't think, unless there are going to be enough people who tap into the magic and the mythical and the mental in the healthiest way, I don't look towards the future for anything like inspiration, because it's going to be grim. So I think there's got to be enough people who are interested in this, and even if it's a small group of people, that they can refine their skills and chunk down and chunk slow and start to coordinate these different capacities. And I will say that the only one I did see, I can't remember his name. He's a brilliant scholar, a Gebser scholar. But he was talking about Samadhi and Satori and Gebser's description. I think he was speaking to Suzuki. Suzuki saying that wasn't Samadhi, it was Satori. And I will confess to you that I found that very disappointing. Not the presentation, it's brilliant, but I think if this is what Gebser has come up with for a description of the apperceptible, I find that extremely disappointing. I would hope for a whole lot more than just a back and forth conversation about is this Samadhi or Satori. I believe we've gone. Those of us who have explored sex, drugs, rock and roll, and taken a walk on the wild side, some of us may not have, but those of us who did, I can tell you this looks pretty tame. And if you've done lucid dreaming or had any out-of-body experiences or held the hand of someone who's dying, you get lots of flashes of, I wouldn't call them altered states of consciousness, but because that would presuppose there's a unaltered state of consciousness, which I've not discovered yet. But I'm just saying, I think we need to do better than what was quoted as what Gebser was saying. And I think we can. I think we must. And I believe he would definitely encourage us, because I think we know a lot more than he did about a lot of things that we haven't quite owned yet. And so that's my very unambitious plan for the time that I have left on this planet, to try to create the conditions for the possibility of that occurring on a much larger scale than it has. I think we can see signs of it, and that I think the list that was compiled, I think that was done about 20 years ago. He wrote that book by Michael Murphy, and he's probably spoken since about this. I think it's kind of ordinary. You know, like you open up a book and you find the passage you're looking for. You know, those tiny little synchronistic events that happened almost every day, or the doorbell rings or you think about a friend you haven't seen in 20 years and you bump into them on a street corner. I mean, those are the kind of things that happen to many of us, I'm sure. But I think they all are sort of like surface structures that Michael Murphy's pointing out to, that there's a much deeper structure that they're all pointing to. So anyway, that's the big chunk that I've been working on for the last year here. And I don't know what happens next, but I'm extremely curious. Thank you.
If I can just add one thing to what you just said, John. The differentiation, I took the quote that you just referenced between Samadhi and Satori a little differently. There are lots of people who think you get somewhere and you end up somewhere, and that integrality is like being somewhere or being some way. And I think what the Gebser-Suzuki interchange points to is it's not what you think it is. We love to categorize, we love to define and say, well, it's this and it's not that. And that's not what either of them is actually talking about. Not everybody has had, no, let me rephrase that. Everybody has had the metanormal/paranormal kind of experiences that you've just described. But the number of people that I have encountered or met in life who were even slightly aware of what they went through very rapidly approaches zero statistically. It's just a handful in the end, because we lack that fundamental awareness. I only saw one of the presentations thus far, and that was Hans's. And he talked about the space of awareness and focusing in, and how subject and object kind of arises in an awareness space, and eliminating this duality. And it's not so much an elimination as the superseding of, getting over it, getting through it. You have to see it all at once. You kind of, and this is what I like about, you know, Marco's idea about holding the paradox before you at all times is simply, my feeling, two's enough. You don't need a multiplicity of things. The moment you get the third, the fourth, and the fifth, then people start getting distracted and miss the point. That's why Spencer Brown says it's a fundamental distinction. Multiplicity begins with two. And being aware of that is, I believe, one of the strongest steps in any direction that we can make in recognizing that two-ness is multiplicity in and of itself. It's also manageable. This is where I agree with you. Let's chunk it down, chunk it slow. You don't need all of it. You can do it with two. You can experience that whole range with just two, if you get down to that. You know. So it's this increasing the awareness of what I am experiencing at all times, that I think is what we need. What we need. This is what I try to focus on for the most part in most of my life. is simply being aware of that. And it's that that increased awareness without the the specific focus that comes with perspectival viewing of things, or thinking that we got to have the right point of view. No, we have to be aware and awareness. And that gets described in lots and lots of ways. You know, you can read the whole gamut from east to west to whatnot. And everybody says it a little differently, but they're all saying the same thing. It's being said in so many different ways so that anybody, this is my point, anybody can get it if they want to.
I really appreciate that you chunked down. You gave us a good example of chunking down and chunking slow. There's that distinction. And I think it was Spencer Brown who said, once you make a distinction, you can go across and you can go back. Where the whole thing starts.
The whole thing, yeah, the whole thing is there. The whole thing.
So it's, and you can if you can remember, you went across the distinction that went back. And if you can remember that happened,
mm-hmm.
then you can explore boundary conditions. And I think most what you said was very true. Most people don't remember that.
No, they just don't.
They have amnesia. They black out. That's what Aurobindo said. There's a constant veiling. The veil comes down. The veil comes up. The veil comes down again. I'm hoping that we can lift the veil and keep the veil up long enough so that we can decide we want to bring it down, rather than it just automatically doing so and obscuring something that we knew something happened, but we had no clue what it was.
Well, what it was.
Mm-hmm. It's a very skill. I hope we can learn.
It is a skill, and what factors into this from my angle, and Marco pointed it out as far as the stereoscopic vision, the body naturally sees two-ness. And if you've been traumatized, I think that interferes with learning the skill. I like what everybody's saying here because it relates to me getting back to a childlike relationship to being able to just hold two perspectives and work with that and feel the field or between them and develop the skill. And that's why I think for me, beginning with the body that naturally does this and bringing awareness to how we've been taught, conditioned to work this skill of stereoscopy, because our family, our surroundings tell us what to do with that. It's only because of drugs, rock and roll, and stuff in my trauma that I reset it. I said, no, fuck it. You know, you guys are all wrong. I know what the reality is, you know. But then I learned that, no, I don't know what reality is, but I can practice like Ed's saying. I'm just going to use the phrase holistic awareness, because even though I can see the two, there's a third component. There's a third perspective that, you know, a spatial perspective that's holding the two that a lot of people forget. They don't feel it, because I think it is more of a feeling than an actual visual thing. It's that you see two, but you actually feel three, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I think it's overlapping senses engaged.
Yeah, and that's true. That's true.
Visual, kinesthetic, auditory, it's multi-sensory.
So how do we learn? We're taught to, I think we're taught to favor one over the other and not, I may have a certain seeing, strength in seeing versus feeling, but we should work with all the senses.
John's a big advocate of working with all of the senses.
Say that again.
John's a big advocate of working with all the senses.
Yeah.
I think that's a real important thing. Just to add on one little point, I think it's socially, societally, we're taught not to feel. We're actually desensitized.
Exactly.
We need to regain the sensitivity that is inherent in everything that we do. We have to feel that. You know, the Kabbalists tell us Our feelings tell us what to think.
And not be afraid of it. I think the layer
of afraid of it. You have to embrace it because.
Right, Ed. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, John, I broke you off there. Sorry.
No. I am enjoying this conversation. I just wanted to say that when I expressed disappointment about Gebser's conversation with Suzuki, I mean, these are two great scholars from different backgrounds. And the conversation about Satori and Samadhi, I just feel it is, my complaint, I don't know what where the complaint exactly comes from, but I think it's because of all these overlapping senses and the multidimensional nature of many experiences that I have had and that others have reported, that I believe, I just feel like Samadhi and Satori debates about that, there's already a taxonomy in place. Mm-hmm. And it's been passed on. Someone under a Bodhi tree had an insight, some sort of mystical experience. And then it gets passed on from generation to generation to generation. And these are the practices. This is the recipe. You follow this and you'll get that experience. And I believe that in the Western traditions, that's there too. I'm all for those traditions being explored, but I also think that something else is happening that has much more to do. I mean, we already know the AI. They already have military robots in a planning stage, so that, you know, this the economic situation that we're in has never had been able to be backed up so completely by undefeatable, potentially military force. And I think this makes Hitler look like small-time stuff, really, or Stalin. But I think that's why we have to be much more imaginative than probably, you know, our predecessors have ever had to be about how to manage the complex social landscapes that are emerging now. And I don't think we have a whole lot of time to figure this out. And I'm being optimistic. I think maybe two or three generations. And I'm not of the opinion that we can sit back and just go into Samadhi or Satori or have debates about which one is which and make a whole lot of possibilities open up for the future people that I believe Gebser was referencing in many of his books. And I believe that's where those visionary capacities start to become highly activated. It's orienting towards the future rather than doing comparative studies with some altered state that somebody had two centuries ago. And that's been translated into Sanskrit and 100 other languages. I think that kind of task is for certain people, it's a perfect thing for them to study. But I find myself getting very frustrated because I think we can do better than this.
Can I jump in real quick?
You can jump in real long if you want to.
All right. Well, I just couldn't see if somebody else was trying to speak. So I guess, Johnny, one thing that distinction has meant for me, and I don't know if you'll find this meaningful, but it's so different from Wilbur's understanding of integral. So Gebser got his understanding of integral from Satori, which means something that's not mental rational. And like Bonita Roy points out, Wilbur's idea of integral is still a good map of the prison, or it's written from a mental rational place and categorized that way. I think that leads to some of the attributes of it, like the fact that hierarchies are understood so to be such a profound thing. And I think it also leads to a playing down of diversity, whereas a Gebser Satori integral, diversity is inherent and they arise in multiplicity. I think there could still be a potential transpersonal devaluing of diversity and what it means, but we lose all that mean green mean stuff and we get into a state experience of expanding beyond I don't know exactly what to say there, but things arise more, what I learned from Ed, right? The synaresis takes over or is more predominant. I understood that better after reading what Ed wrote about it than I did previously. So I don't know, that's just one of the things that makes a difference for me is I felt like if Ken Wilber had gotten that that's what integral was to Gebster and that Gebster saw it in real good poetry and that if he had gotten that artistic piece of it, I might feel better about being part of the Wilber world.
Could there be more than one integral, though? I mean,
that's a good question.
I think the art scene is nourished by Steiner and Gebser more than I think. Wilber is definitely into the arts, but I don't think he's a practitioner of that of the arts as much as he is a practitioner of the sciences. I think that's his biggest emphasis, and I think those who are attracted to the weird or the anomalous or the, you know, the strange and the uncanny were, you know, sort of lumped into the sort of magic mythic crowd. I believe that a lot of the Wilberians had not read any Steiner or any Gebser. If they had, I think they would have modified their superior tone.
Well, reading somebody off. I think, well, chain still cells. Mobile cells.
The towers, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, can always happen. I think one of the things that, you know, the different kinds of integrals, I think it's not monolithic. This is another thing that I think too often comes up. Everybody thinks, oh, we're all kind of like think the same way or be the same way or feel the same way. And if that were the case, then it couldn't possibly, as far as I'm concerned, be integral because it's become a monoculture. It's the absolute and everything else is not that. And that's very mental rational. That's the thing that bothers me when I hear a lot of people discussing these kinds of things. It's everything, it's nothing at the same time, because, you know, if you look into the history of science, you said the uncanny, you know, is it a wave, is it a particle, how does a proton decide which slit to go through is as uncanny as it gets, as far as I'm concerned. And an appreciation of that uncanniness, and that our uncanniness is actually, you know, I don't know normality, what it actually is, but it's probably closer to that than anything else. But back to what, you know, we had said before, we're systematically taught not to honor or acknowledge that. We gotta clear that out. That's the detritus, that it has to be swept away or burnt off so that we can become normal, whatever the hell that is, you know. And I think that's the part that we're actually fighting against. And that's why it's so difficult. good move there, Marco. That's the part that we're working so hard against. And I think that's the part that's frustrating you right now, John, because there is a lot of resistance to that because people want to, what the Germans would say, make a Dingfest, make it thing sound. You know, something that you could actually get a hold of or grasp. Well, no, you can't really grasp it. That's just a metaphor that we use for getting something, you know, and we mistake the metaphor for the reality.
Well, my main interest is in holding the paradox. And in order to hold a paradox, you have to make a distinction. And I've made several, and so have all of you. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. So we've all made different distinctions, and we can continue to do that. And then what happens? Well, if enough of us can hold the tension rather than turn into a dogmatic food fight about who has the right one, right position, I think this would be an alternative that would be very good for us and for everybody else than that typical kind of polarization that happens. And I think it's about our maturity that we can come forward with a tension that we're holding And it isn't going to be pleasant all the time. Sometimes the one who holds the paradox, it's very uncomfortable. Whereas the person who doesn't hold the paradox, but is feeling totally right about everything, feels fabulous.
Well, it's like the metaphor that the person that's holding the paradox is the bridge, and then he gets walked on by both sides. You know, and I'm a wrestler, so I know what it's like to have somebody on my back that I don't want on my back, you know. But I concur, John. It's, to me, it's that skill set of holding the tension that has become the most present in my life, is holding the tension, because out of my life experience, I and my trauma, I learned I was letting the tension, I was reactive and reacting to the tension, and it was out of a conditioned response. Mm-hmm. And so the trauma reset my goals, kind of say, and I'm still working with the skill set of holding attention, but I do it a lot better than I did it 5 years ago. I do it a lot better. I did just recently have a incident on a bus where somebody was trying to preach to me about the Bible and stuff. I said, you need to shut up. I don't want to listen to you. Because he was preaching from the view of being a sinner and stuff, and I was trying to listen to him, but he went down that road of sinner, and amongst the whole people on the bus, I said, I don't want to hear you anymore. And I told him, I'm not going to listen to you. He kept talking. I turned and looked out the window as everything was going by, and I modeled, I'm not listening to you. And but I did it a lot better than I did it 5 years ago, because I would have been screaming at the top of my head, you freaking idiot.
But well, that's holding the tension right there.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, exactly, Marco.
Because you're being nice, but you're also, you know, being, practicing self-care, basically, right?
And a form of authenticity. There's a threat of being authentic in those situations too.
I like the image of like your arm being twisted, the torsion, the paradox, paradoxical torsion.
Yeah.
Reality kind of putting you in an arm lock and wrestling you.
Yeah.
Until you either can slip out somehow or cry uncle.
Yeah, or you got a jawbone and you know.
I just wanted to put these on because I have samadhi in one eye.
The other. I love it.
That's good. So
I also have an idea. So this was just kind of a stunt, but what it was really coming out of was this inquiry of what happens next? What do we do with all this? Because we've had a lot of conversations. We can go on talking about Gebser for another 47 years. Right? It's like,
well, maybe you can. I don't know. I got 47 on.
Well, this was what I, you know, they've been doing these conferences for that long. That's why it may be 48 or something. And I think there's still a profundity to what he's pointing to. I think the transformation or the mutation he's talking about is real. I think he was seeing some aspects of it, and we've seen many more aspects of it now since that time. There's been a much more of a flowering of the paranormal and the weird and the psychedelic and all of that, which he didn't, you know, he was just glimpsing in its relatively more abstract forms, like abstract art, quantum physics, German poetry. But now it's popular. I mean, we're in the throes of it. And so how do we deal with that? How will we deal with what's happening now? I think this cosmovision, this is the thought I had, is some kind of compendium, some kind of like feast of like concretions, to use the Gebserian language, of what has been brought forth, what has been explored, what has been learned. Cosmovision 2020, because we have this year coming up in a particular calendar, in a particular time structure. But nonetheless, there's a certain poetry to that fact, 2020. And it's going to be a really stressful year, probably a volatile year in many ways because of the U.S. elections and so forth. It's more than a year away. And the idea would be, can we really collaborate on putting together some kind of vision, like some kind of, what do we see? What is real? What do we understand? What do we want to have happen? And what wants to happen? Like those, there are all kinds of questions like that, that we could, I think, use the torsion of those questions to resolve a view, more than a view, because like if I'm wearing these glasses and we get into a conversation, we're not just going to talk about what we see. We have to know that what we feel, what we hear, what we taste, what we know, what we don't know, what we wonder, maybe we tell each other our dreams. Maybe there's, special kind of insert for the glasses or something like that. And that's like the alternate realities module. And then when you meet somebody, you share your dreams. Maybe something is learned there through this occult meeting. I'm just playing with that. But
we're already doing that. On alternate, we have a meetup next Wednesday, not this Wednesday. But we've already had sessions, and that's exactly what we do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's happening.
Yeah, I know.
But I think on a grand scale, it would be fascinating if more and more people start to develop those skills and do what you just did this weekend with Heather and Jeffrey, working with the quantum poetics. I thought this was an excellent experiment in alternate ways of knowing. Can we create a poetry together and sort of that subject-object grid that we're so used to, can we deconstruct that and create poetry without, falling into chaos? So I was wondering, that's what I got from the rehearsal last time, and I haven't seen the performance yet, but I just wanted to invite, you and Heather to share with us anything that you learned or something that's changed because of your participation in that experiment. So, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you if you were in a role there.
No, not at all. I would love to hear more from Heather, and Michael's also asking for time.
So this is going to be clumsy. It feels like I have to use my metaphor of wrestling because that's what's closest to me. When you wrestle, you never know what's going to happen next. But at the same time, you have skills to work with what happens next, and you actually have to work from a feeling level from the other body on you and what they're doing. And there's a certain trusting the struggle for what emerges out of that, I'm going to say, paradox. So there seems to be, for the vision to come forward or articulate itself, the feeling capacity has to trust what emerges, kind of like what Aaron Manning was talking about that subtle minor gesture, right? I mean, I'm just trying to riff off of you, Marco.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mark Jabor had posted an article at one point, and I forget exactly all it was about. But the final point of it had something to do with how social harmonies are established. Mm. And it not having so much to do with following a particular way or set of rules, but with a lot of very small interactions. It's like the back and forth, each little thing, like the aggregate of all that is what gives you the overall pattern, right? And then when you try to impose one particular set of rules or one particular set of frameworks, even an integral one, and John has said this too, you actually end up causing chaos and confusion. So you don't allow the inherent order to arise naturally and to dissolve naturally, because orders are constantly arising and dissolving, and there are some stable patterns there, and we can cultivate and cohere those. And I think those are what we get to through the interactions, through the conversations.
And when I say what happens next, I'm not saying what do you predict is going to happen next. I'm just saying you and I and all of us are anticipatory creatures. We would not have survived.
Okay.
And so we are, you may not know exactly what the guy you're wrestling with, or gal, is going to come at you with, but you're going to, but you are going to anticipate.
Yeah,
that movement is going to, if it continues in that velocity, in that direction, is going to have certain kinds of consequences that I need to prepare for.
Yeah, and I just want to...
But it's not a cognitive decision.
No, it's not. But on a feeling level...
Yes.
On a feeling level, it feels like more than wrestling a person, I'm wrestling the chaos that's coming at me. I'm wrestling it and trying to get order. There's a very visceral, muscular, trying to put order to this, whatever this... There's a person, but... his moves are chaotic to me, even though I try to anticipate them. You know, you're right, John. You do try to anticipate. And it's just a matter of skill set, of trusting your own training and knowing that, you know, it's a crapshoot if you end up on your back or not and pinned. You know? So... Yeah,
but there's a difference, I get what you're saying. A friendly fight or whether it's somebody you meet. There's a difference in the situation, whether that fight is a friendly fight and you're practicing and you're elevating each other through the intensity of that struggle, where you're training each other, you know, through the intensity that you bring to the match.
Right.
That's one kind of context. And then there's the kind that happens, you know, on the street.
On the bus.
Right.
Or if you're writing a sonnet, talking about chaos.
Oh, yeah.
Or you're doing a music with somebody, or you're, you know, changing a baby's diaper. you have to orchestrate very delicate movements, and you have a desired outcome, but how you're going to get there will vary a great deal.
Well, and one thing I can say that, like you made the distinction, Marco, that it's a different context if I'm training to wrestle and compete and challenge myself with other people and then running in on the street. But the practice of training with people like I feel I'm doing in dialogue with you guys is safe enough that I think I'm just going to say it contributed to the way I dealt with the person on the bus. And there was a certain, I'm going to say, broadly an erotic feeling of pleasure that I did okay. I did good by the way I responded outside the dojo per se. Because there's an eroticism and that's a big term, but it's just a matter of the eroticism representing to me the feeling, the raw primal feeling that Ed points to and John, of how feelings inform our thinking.
Yeah, I think it's what Aurobindo calls the delight of being. I think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. That's a nice term.
And also, you know, there's situations like this conversation here, your encounter on the bus, but then there's the larger situation. We're not in a mental totality, but we're in a totality. So that feeling of chaos coming at you, that's happening. That's like a chronic condition, that we're in. This is part of the crisis that Gebser was talking about.
Okay.
And John was talking about as being exponentially more severe and catastrophic now than it even was then, because mainly because of the technology and because of the numbers of people and because of the stakes. The stakes were always the same, but we're in that situation as well. And so part of the question, I think, has to do with scale. Like, and we have to transform culture, right? That's not just an ideal. That's not just an idealistic objective. I think that when I think about what kind of world do I want my daughters to live in? You know, what kind of world would have prevented somebody that I cared about from, you know, taking their own life or, you know, committing some terrible act that they would later regret. All of that arises from conditions. This is not, it's not just a fluke. It's not just an accident that things are the way they are. So that, I think, enjoins us to take a different kind of responsibility. And as vast and infinite as reality is, that doesn't mean that we don't have effects. That doesn't mean that we don't have, that our will is irrelevant. But all of this is hard to talk about. And part of the challenge of what we've been doing is just getting our hands on that, you know, the multi-tentacled beast of a wrestling partner that, you know, we're dealing with. But I feel that we could go on forever talking, we can go on forever reading, but can we resolve something? Like, can we resolve some concretion, right? I don't even like that word because it's too concrete. But nonetheless, why aren't people always talking about this? Why aren't they always sharing their dreams? Why aren't they always having philosophical debates, or not debates, but you know, like considerations? Like, let's actually think this through. Let's actually feel this through. Well, this should be happening all the time and everywhere, because the scale and the magnitude of what we're facing means business as usual is suicide.
Well, I totally agree. I can only go from my slice of pie and out there in the world of running into what you're talking about and using my perceptual skills of why they might not be doing it, even though I wish they would. Personally, I think they're consumed by their own fear of difference, of encountering something different. They're consumed by it. And all I know, as far as a resolve on my personal level, which I agree with you, it needs to be taken larger, is how do I make it a resolve of how do I encounter people out there. And my father had a saying that helps me along this way. And there's a Spanish, and I can't quote it, it's poco a poco something, but it basically said, little by little, we go a long way. And that's why I like chunk down, chunk slow. Because I think if we keep doing that, clarifying and actually doing what we're doing of kind of bringing coherence to the vision, you know, I personally have faith that, I don't know the sum total, but it's enough for me. That's all I know.
I just want to say a resolution can have like the sense of will resolved, you know, that, but it also has the sense of definition, like in terms of visual perception.
Okay.
So high resolution means all many, many little pixels, little things. Okay. And each pixel is clear. In a way, we could say that this resolution of seeing reality clearly, or knowing ourselves, or whatever, however you, frame those questions, is about many, many little things becoming clear. And then the picture that emerges from those is more high def. But that's like the quantum, you know, digital version of it, I guess.
Yeah.
And I think there's also the more flowing wave-like mysterious version of that, that, you know, isn't as cognitive. But that's also part of what I think we are envisioning, is a polyphasic culture, more fluid culture.
Right.
One thought I had, this is just an idea, but from Octavia Butler's book, which we read in another group, Parable of the Sower, one of the characters is envisioning and then initiating a new kind of religious movement. And she's imagining what does people need? They need long-term goals. They need big things to do. And she proposes traveling to other planets and making homes on other planets, that this is the destiny that you know, would give meaning and purpose to human life. But I wonder if we could begin to identify some like spiritual, like some imminent kind of you know, goals, purposes. Here's just like a crazy idea. Like, imagine that the goal was to be, to have awareness or consciousness 24/7, right? Like, this is a yogic, like, you know, it's a yogic goal to maintain unbroken awareness through all the states of waking, dreaming, deep sleep, and to have access to all those states and be able to move between them through the, you know, through the force of one's realization. What if that were a large-scale cultural goal? What if that were something that could be realized through, you know, all the structures of you know, of society, education, family, friends, social relations? What if that were part of what was striven for? I mean, that would give humanity purpose. That gives me purpose. Like, if that this is something that we've discussed on the forum, these kind of collective experiments. It's just an idea of the kind of things that, you know, would be easier to do if there were a lot of people doing them, and if it weren't so obscure and weird, and if it weren't so, you know, much identified with the ashram or with, you know, with the academy or with any of these other specialized places. Because that, and I imagine many more ideas like that could come. And part of the point would be that it would really be, really have to come through the collective. It really would have to come through the field. And part of what I've learned, and I want to circle back to your question, John, and also, since Heather's still here, invite her and loop that back in. What I learned this weekend, one of the things, with respect to our presentation on quantum field poetics, was that as we got closer to the time that that event was going to occur, and as I became less fixated on that performance and the other things that had to be organized and done, put together, and allowed all the other things that were happening in the field to arise and to allow myself to witness them and to receive them and not stress. The kind of the stress point, the tension point that presentation was, relaxed a lot. And so I felt a lot more relaxed when we actually presented than when we did the rehearsal. So I think doing the rehearsal helped, but then, and it sort of maybe also made it easier to relax when everybody else was doing their things and just listen and be present, let the conversation unfold, so that when our moment came, I felt really quite ready for it. And I could critique my own performance and things I may have flubbed or whatever, but the moment felt appropriate. And I think that, we all adjusted to each other and we adjusted to the room in a way that was, in my experience, integral. What do you think, Heather? How was it for you?
I resonate with that. I think for me, I was reflecting on my process and how the rehearsal allowed me to fully utilize the process that I like to have available to me, which is I laid out I made the first gestures of creation prior to our rehearsal. So I started to find a structure. It started to emerge because it had to, because I had to be ready to present. And then I had the time to digest and metabolize that structure. So that was maybe my favorite part of the rehearsal, is that I could feel the things that didn't quite flow. And then when right before the presentation, I was able to move a few slides that had felt, just based on my felt sense, like I knew kind of where I wanted them to go, how I wanted to retitle them. I was relaxed, but I had also, I think, relaxed in the room with the people. I didn't feel pressure to perform as much as I wanted to share with them what the three of us were excited about. I wanted to have them experience our poetry, because I also, like the other two, wound up inserting creative work in the middle instead of more academic talk. We were last, so while there was a little time pressure, there was also, I think, more freedom, a little more playfulness maybe. The room was relaxed, it felt like. It had gone through a whole cycle over those 3 days. I was sad we didn't have a chance to have the roundtable discussion at the very end and really see if people were interested in that project of holding and fencing, holding and carrying the field, because I even thought of that today as something I'm still carrying forward, as Marco invited us to carry the field of the conference forward into our lives and beyond. And that's something that's still with me. So, and it's a tension. It's a not knowing what will come out of that carrying experience or if it will come to a type of fruition. But I've been wondering what the future of the Gebser Conference is going to be like if a lot of the members are aging and probably not going to be, well, I not to be insulting, but realistic, not always able to attend. And we have a younger faction that's a little more disorganized, maybe a little less committed and consistently committed. And so there's this difference, this gap in level of love for Gebser and maybe what he meant to them, especially when he was newer, you know, a newer voice in the United States. He's still new. He's still not recognized or understood, even in these schools, these alternative institutions. No one really pays much attention. So, yeah, I just have had some questions, I think, from carrying the field come up like that.
Well, just a quick note, Jeremy is working on a Gebser 101 introductory book. This is going to be one of the next things he publishes. So there's that, I don't know the future of the Gebser conference. I'm not going to be an organizer most likely, but yeah. I'm happy to attend if it's around, if it's accessible. Like it was, you know, in Europa. But I think that like the Gebser, maybe really we should absorb and we should refine our focus, I think. What questions do we actually need to address, explore, work out in common? Because it's a great opportunity to be in person. We're going to meet later on with Jeffrey, and Jeffrey has been in town, and just to be in person and be able to take the time to have long conversations and have a glass of wine and that kind of a thing. You get to think things through and work things out and have allow resonance to develop that. But it's expensive to travel and to get multiple people in the same place at the same time. And that's significant. It's easy to do virtually. Well, even virtually, it's not that easy in many ways, but like, how would we make the most of an occasion like that? You know, what would be a real intensification, right? Like carrying the spirit and the teaching that Gebser, you know, gives, but transmuting it into what is really needed.
You gotta wear your glasses?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, we're all gonna. Well, I'm gonna ask Jeffrey to design them because I mind you.
I was very touched by what you said, Heather, about the older crowd in the Gebser gatherings, who've kept this flame alive, and then there's younger people coming forward, like yourself and Jeremy and Marco, who are having to ask these questions. I think it's, I quoted somebody recently, a philosopher of mathematics, and she was just talking about, she looked at all these mathematical discoveries and the initial problem and the conditions for solving that problem often took centuries. So we may be, it's intergenerational. And I think each generation, there are going to be some members of that generation who are going to be weird and odd and not follow that well-beaten path to job security and to the perfect spouse. And, I'm moved by that as I've had these questions too. As I'm getting older, what is it that I want to pass on, if anything? I mean, I've had so many dead ends in my career, in the multiple careers I've had, and I've had so many disasters in my life that I wouldn't wish on anybody. But I think Gebser did too. You know, there are famines and there are wars and there are outbreaks of disease, and you know, your plans just don't work. And so, as anticipatory systems, we have to figure this out. So I think that's a great question. Oh, I remember this a friend of mine, just to illustrate this. He was in his mid-20s, and he was he loved Frank Sinatra. And I asked, why do you like Frank Sinatra? Who comes from my grandparents' generation, you know? I couldn't fathom. And then he said, oh, you just listen to the old Frank Sinatra. You don't know him in his middle period. And he turned me on to some Frank Sinatra in his middle period. And I really recognized, oh, this guy had a voice and he had a style. And there's a real charisma. And so now I understand why the people who love Frank Sinatra love Frank Sinatra. But I didn't expect it from a 25-year-old. And so I was the one who was the beneficiary of his sort of weirdness, that he was attracted to something in the culture that wasn't specific to his type or his generation. Anyway, I find that fascinating, what we carry forward, what we drop, what we forget, and what we remember, and how we pass on what we value most, and we do that with as much integrity as we can. I believe that we can anticipate enormous creative breakthroughs. We don't know where exactly they're going to come, or where or when, but we can confidently know that we're creating conditions for some breakthrough. It may not happen in our lifetime. I think we have to sort of live with that, that we may not live to see this, but that the future peoples won't be able to thank us personally because they won't know who we were. But that, you know, I was very aware when I started to become an adult that I'm sitting in a nice restaurant with a clean white tablecloth, having a lovely friendship and sipping a glass of wine, because there are millions of people who lived before me who created the conditions for me to enjoy a little civilization. So I think this is like Gebser notes over and over again. This is whatever we achieve, many, many humans have sacrificed in order for that to happen.
Yeah, thank you for sharing those reflections. I was one of the attendees, Glenn Aparicio Perry, who's more of a shaman, but he has a kind of a shamanic orientation, but a Gebserian outlook, and wrote an interesting looking book called Original Thinking, Thinking Like from the Origin. Anyway, he led us in a dialogue, which was maybe one of my favorite experiences, and I don't think it's recorded. And the dialogue, there were moments of it that felt a little bit like we were reading his diary. I don't know. It was a little personal in the opening up of the space, but he did the rituals, you know, and opened the space. And I have mixed feelings around some of those things that I'd explore in another form. but the dialogue that followed was, I thought, really great. He invited us to speak from our guidance, our knowing, our wisdom, to really listen and receive what wanted to be said. And it felt like a mandala was created. And so a few people at the conference did talk about how, I forget how they put it exactly, but something about what was happening at the conference being a sort of, I don't know even quite what to say, but, you know, having ripple effects, essentially, or seeding a greater potential just by our being together and practicing. And, you know, I've heard various spiritual groups say that, and I've had various ways of looking at that idea and even feeling it to be true at times and then being skeptical like now. So I found that dialogue gave me hope for that kind of, you know, it's like a Baum, David Baum dialogue. It was teaching people to speak from them, their sense of self, their sense of higher self, and unified with their bodies and their minds. And if Integral can do that, then I'd love to keep trying to offer it to people, you know. I don't know, that was just one thought that was still with me after what you said.
I think one of the things we need to keep in mind is that when we talk, all of us, all the time, we always speak from the most, from the deepest, most personal part of our beings. We don't like to think that we are. And we love to think that we're putting on a show, and we love to think that our persona is right out there doing what we think it's supposed to do. But in truth, we're just being ourselves. We're not aware of who we are and what ourselves are. And if you're going to, if the only thing that we can change is in the world, I believe, is ourselves. We can't change the conditions, and we can't change other people, and we can't do lots of things, but we can change ourselves. If we don't like ourselves, we can change ourselves. If we want to be different, we can be different, even if it's a faux difference through our personas. But that's the only opportunity that we have. But we are, I think, societally conditioned, like we had mentioned before, to not do that, to think that it's some way else. When we realize how real thoughts are and how much impact we actually have on our environments, it is one of the most terrifying experiences in most people's lives, because I didn't realize I had an impact. And then you realize you do. And now you have to do something with it, because with knowledge comes obligation. That's what I learned in my esoteric training. And most people shirk it, because it's too hard to do and it's too hard to maintain. But we're but the paradox of it all is we do it anyway. We just continue, whether we're bumbling our ways through life or whether we're actually consciously trying to do something with our lives, that's what we're doing. And it's that simple awareness that I make a difference to more than just me, simply because there's more than just me in the world. And it's a terrible responsibility that we all have to shoulder. And we're going to have to continue to do it anyway. And it's nice to get together with people like yourselves where you can bounce these ideas off, and maybe I could try it this way, or maybe we could do it that way. Here's another insight that, you know, might give us a pointer in another direction. Those are all very helpful things. That's why I like showing up at the cafes and getting these very different points of view, you know. But the only person we got in the end is us. And we all have to, as I believe, make do with what we have.
And I think that's true. I think, though, the way I've taken on shouldering my personal responsibility is actually having the fortune of having a few people model that to me and actually teach me that there's also a sharing of responsibility that can come online once we, I didn't learn my sense of, I know what you're saying, and I don't know if I'm saying this right, but I really learned my sense of responsibility from my grandfather, my dad, and some teachers I love. But they taught me that sense of responsibility in a way that wasn't abusive. Because I think when we, I've raised two kids, I made sure I wasn't going to pass on that sense of responsibility as an authoritarian dictator and treat them like, you know, that wasn't the right way to teach my children the way that, that how real that sense of responsibility is part of their lives. So, yeah, I get it. We have ourselves, but I'm so glad I had people to help model it for me.
I'm going to get going because Heather, Jeffrey, and I are planning something for later, and I'd like to take care of a couple of things. But before I go, last thing I wanted to offer about this responsibility and the carrying the claim. And one thing I noticed and I felt about this gathering this weekend, it felt like these convergences, these occasions when people get together to dwell with, to dwell on, to think on, to be with the integral or whatever you want to call it. Like there's this, I'm just going to say transtemporal, transspatial kind of continuity to them. So last winter when I was in New York, and I went to Alex and Allison Gray's Chapel of Sacred Mirrors, I had the same kind of feeling. Like, these kinds of occasions keep happening. And there is a way in which they reemerge, but they're under the surface of things, liminally. They're keeping a world alive, right? They're keeping a space of awareness alive. And so I think part of the question before us and me is, how do we keep that alive? Because that's been something that's been carried, you know, millennia, perhaps forever, right? In the midst of ignorance and in the midst of darkness and in the midst of chaos and in the midst of, there's always people who keep the flame of awareness alive, and keep the flame of insight or knowledge or heart, or again, it can have many different guises, expressions, and articulations and traditions and lineages. But I appreciate that. And I don't know how exactly we're going to do that, but I think that we are going to do that. And certainly that's my resolution. Thank you. And I'm just going to hop off. I'll make Doug.
Before you do, Marco, do you know if, are you okay with botanical gardens?
let me get back to you, because I have a little logistical snafu that I got to work out with Kayla.
Okay. Well, I sent an email.
Heather?
Yeah.
Heather, before you go, I just wanted to ask, you said something about something had made you sad, that it wasn't completed at the Gebser conference. Something that you wanted to... something you said made you sad, that it wasn't something that you planned to happen, didn't happen at the conference. I was just curious if that could be a topic for some future cafe. I just want to put that out there as a possibility.
Yeah, that's a great idea. So the idea that we could maybe watch our presentation and then have a round table after, I love that.
Yeah. I just want to use this as a, continue to use this as a rehearsal for people who, you know, are working on something. It may not be there yet, but, you know, the vision just doesn't come out of anywhere. It comes out of relationships. And I believe that's, we have our tasks that we have to perform. We also have to have high quality relationships to make these visions actually to implement them. So I hope this cafe can be continued to be a rehearsal space for people who want to try things out. So,
yeah, I love that.
It's to be or not to be determined.
How appropriate.
And to be determined. To be not to be determined. All right. I don't know. I've assigned you this, the co-host, Doug. I don't know what's going to happen when I...
Not much more, because I'm heading out in about 5 minutes, but we can continue to talk. I'll stay on the line after you two leave.
Well, maybe we should start wrapping it up.
Well, John, you like to start gossip sections, it sounded like, so
we could do that.
We could do that for a few minutes. It'll be recorded, so.
Okay, so this is being recorded, and we'll be able to view it later?
Yeah. Yes, for sure.
All right. Well, I'll let you all figure out what you want to do, or you might just all, I might just zap you out of existence when I.
Shit.
So should I take my chances?
Bye.
Well, as long as, thank you all.
Do you want to say something else, John? What?
No. I'm getting ready to go as well. I just wanted to wrap up, and if anyone has any closing statements or wants to continue on talking, that's great. Well, it's recorded, right? So we'll all be at
it. Just a quick reminder that tomorrow at 10, from 10 to 12 Mountain Time, will be the Prospecting Futures Online. So I don't know if you were wanting to participate in that, John, or anybody else that were part of the Octavia Butler group.
Oh, that's the Octavia Butler. Yes, I got a notice for that. Thank you. I plan
to be there.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll be there. All right, to be continued.
So love.
Bye-bye.
So I guess I'm getting ready to wrap up too. So I'm going to let you guys go and you can talk about me behind my back. That's fine.
Oh, John.
I'll be listening to the recording later. I actually brought that up as a note, but I think it may be a good idea that, you know, I was just noting how gossip is can be very destructive, but it also can be very creative because sometimes people say really nice things about someone behind their back and they won't say a nice thing in front of them, but they'll say it behind their back. I've noticed that. And maybe it's not socially acceptable to give people lavish comments. Maybe
some anthropologists say that gossip was the first internet.
I think so.
Good and bad. It helped protect certain people from certain. Don't go there. Those are bad guys.
Right.
Oh, they're having an affair over there.
Could be.
Okay, Doug, I think just left. He's our host.
No, he's here and he's well, floating in and out like a social.
He's floating in and out.
Yeah.
Well, I better go, because I got some errands to run. But I've really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you all.
Bye.
And I hope to see you next time.
Bye, John.
See you, John.
See you later.
No. Mark, you came so fashionably late. Do you have anything to share with us?
Yeah, sure. When are you all going to leave so I can just talk to myself?
I tried that once, but I got such smart-ass answers back, I decided to avoid it in the future.
No, I was at a coffee shop with Jeffrey.
Oh.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Didn't manage to hook up. Okay, that's good.
So we had a, you know, two-plus hour one-on-one, face-to-face, in real life conversation, and it was, you know, tremendously enjoyable.
So it floated your boat.
Floated my boat. Yes.
So what exactly did you learn?
That I
sounds
liked
pretty
him.
Cool.
That I liked him.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
Yeah, we talked about one of the things we talked about was the difference between the different types of communication. The online versus the person to person, and how there really is no substitute for person to person. There's a vibe you can't get in any other format. And we talked about the book trilogy mammoth thing that he's writing, which, you know, being a writer and a instructor of the process of writing, it was fascinating. So that's where I was, and that's why I was late. So yeah, I got Marco's left because he's going to meet with Jeffrey and Heather. Apparently they're going to try and find some psychedelic drugs at the botanical garden to continue their Gebserian, you know.
They're gonna charge the field, huh?
Okay. It was great. I prefer one-on-one conversations. That's just my thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about a lot of things, and it was great to have a personal one-on-one conversation. And oddly enough, or not, this wasn't talked about a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Nor was Gebser, even though he was here for Gebser's thing, which he admitted he was here because he could charge it to use other people's money to fund the whole thing.
And come see you and Marco and Heather, huh?
Yeah, and how that's different than one-on-one, being in a public group forum,
mm-hmm.
How all these different means of communicating are different.
Yeah, one-on-one and even group in person is different, you know?
Yes, that's what you just...
When you add a third person, it changes the dynamic of, you know, FaceTime.
That's what he was saying about the conference that Heather and Marco were just talking about, was that that's a different experience. Meeting, he met for the, and, you know, I don't know if he'll watch this or not. So, and I'm talking behind his, I'm talking behind his back.
But I think, you wouldn't say it if you wouldn't say it to his face.
I think these are safe. I think these are safe things to talk about, in that all those means of communication are different. In that, this is the first time he met Marco and Heather, but it was in a group, setting, a public setting, which is different from where he and I met, you know, face to face. We were in a public place, a coffee shop, but it was, you know, just the two of us, and how all those different ways of interacting with people are different.
Yeah, that's really true. Really true. And also, just I'll just throw this in, and I know you probably agree, is that from one day to the next, each time is different. When when you meet somebody one day, and the very next day, it's going to be different. Even
except
then,
except for your wife, which you come to hate.
No, she was the one that put me on the spot that every day is a new day with her. It wasn't the same day.
Yeah. So we talked about that. We talked about a lot of things. It was great. I really
good.
And Marco's left, and at the very end, I brought up the fact that, you know, Marco mentioned on some thread somewhere here about trying to get everybody together to have a retreat for the Cosmos Cafe.
Right.
And I suggested some things to him, and. Yeah, and I just came in the second half and getting that there's nothing like people actually sharing a physical space and getting together. And I hope Marco, Caroline, who's ever in charge, pulls it off before I go off into Gebser land.
The newest sphere.
The newest sphere. Because it'd be fabulous to just, you know.
Yeah, it would be.
Well, are you writing about this in your new book?
My new book is about the election. It's not about this, although.
Well, that's an alternate reality to me.
Well, the book pulls everything together. And Marco's in it,
mm-hmm.
for sure. And there's a link to this website and conversation.
Oh, nice!
It's sort of it's footnoted,
mm-hmm.
Because I started the thing 3 years ago. I thought, you know, I thought it would conclude at the inauguration in the March on Washington, which it does in some sense. The book. But it's been, there's been 2 years of things after that. But it's also I've now got the go-ahead. It's been approved. It's in the copy editing process. And hopefully it might be available by Christmas. And you can...
Wow.
Yeah.
You're gonna post that on the website so I can go out and buy it, right?
Well, I still haven't figured out the website, if there's a place to do that, or if that's too capitalistic, or you know, how the whole thing works.
Well, just send me a message through the web, you know, send me an email or whatever.
Yeah, there it'd be great to discuss it in full with a group of smart people. The last smart people on the planet.
Well, I like to sit.
Where the hell are you going to find them?
Right here. Right here. Infinite conversation.
Oh, well, you set the bar pretty low.
I want to sit with your book and telepathically get your thoughts through your book.
Well, who knows?
That's what Stephen King said writing is. It's a form of telepathy.
It's a lot of things. It's a lot of things. It's a good
thing. Yeah, right.
It's a good thing.
Oh, definitely.
So, anyway, yeah. That's all I have to say, Ed. Take it away.
No, I was just curious. I'm glad you were obliging. It's very helpful. Huh? Missed you there at the beginning. I'm glad you had a good reason for being late.
Huh? Yeah,
you really had a bad reason for being late. What the hell? You're late. There.
No. This is my social life.
Oh my God, Mark!
I know,
yeah. Mark.
Yeah. I know.
Do we need to get a Kickstarter and get you a girlfriend?
And then take odds on how long she'd last.
Well, no, you have to submit the you know, we have to check off so many things, you know.
Well, that was Jeffrey and I talked about that, how you can do that. You can have your criteria and your list and everything, but all that goes out the window as soon as you're in the same space face to face.
And as soon as you kiss, it goes out the window, in my experience. It's all in the kiss.
Well,
so yeah, I know, well, I know.
Somebody wrote a song about that back in the 50s.
Yes, they did. They did. That and girl watching. I'm a girl watcher, watching girls go by.
So yeah. One of the things, Jeffrey's book, I don't know if you guys went to his website or tuned into it, but it's futuristic, and it's really an immense project.
Wow. Yeah.
But he deals with, way into the future, these same problems.
Sort of like the more things change, the more they stay the same.
There you go. Whoever said that.
That was a wise man, huh?
That was a wise person.
Yeah, wise person. Okay. You can
they go. Were wise.
They were wise. Yeah.
So.
I'll go with that.
Yeah, it was. It's a shame, Ed, that you couldn't attend this Gebser retreat.
Yeah, it was a conference. Yeah.
Conference.
Get together. Yeah. Party. Whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, and then hearing people's perspective who were there is interesting. But yeah, it seems like you should have been front and center.
No, they asked if I could video in. It turned out that I had things to do on Friday and Sunday evening, and we were kicking around maybe televideoing in on Saturday, and then I realized I wouldn't be able to put something together in time. And then I was informed by my family, I'm always the last person to find out what's going on, that there was a huge family event planned for Saturday. I wasn't even here. So even if I had committed, I would have been in absentia. It's one of those things. So, but you know, well, one of these days, it's, you know, when you live on the other side of the world, I'm not completely on the other side of the world. Aaron Cheek, who is a former president of the Gates of Society, did televideo in from New Zealand. So he held a talk, but he must have been up in the middle of the night to do it. But he's probably more into that. Things I have to say, I save them for when I have people's faces in front of me, for the most part. But it's hard to get anywhere from here. It's just a long way away. Yeah. Takes a long time. You know, it's a 9-hour trip to, well, from my house to New York City is 12 hours.
Wow.
That's just a long time. You know, you got to go to you have to get up early. You have to take a train. You have to go to the airport. You have to wait at the airport. You have to go through security, do that whole thing. It's an 8 or 9 hour flight. So you get there, you got to process out. So, you know, from door to door, you're looking at about 12 hours. Wow. And if it's anything further, Colorado, you know, add 3-4 hours, whatever, depending on what your layover is, wherever you are. And I can tell you that traveling to the United States from outside the United States is not a pleasant experience anyway. So it's just, it is a real hassle. It's a real hassle.
Well, so if Marco and I put the odds at 5%, 1 in 20, if he puts together a retreat for Infinite Conversations, here in Colorado,
I would think very seriously.
How much lead time do you need?
6-8 months.
That makes sense. That actually makes sense.
I retired and I am now like full time employed because we have the grandson a lot and we have other things to do. So I'm engaged in my environment here. One of the other obligations I had that took a lot of my time is now ending in November. So I have a little bit more leeway. But the biggest thing is having lead time to find a reasonably priced flight to get anywhere, because you know they'll take you to the cleaners when you're trying to get from here to there, I can assure you. So when my daughter goes to Florida to visit her husband, my son-in-law's sister and brother-in-law, they go every September, and they book their flights in March or April because they can get the better deal by doing that. So you need a lot of lead time to get a reasonable deal, because it's not – you can get cheap flights that aren't in the end because you pay for everything. The last time I flew to California, I went with a discount flight, and the seat cost, the baggage cost, there's extra charges for everything. You have different kind of limits. There were no amenities. There's no food on the flight. There's, you know, you have to arrange all of that as you're going. It's kind of like camping on a bus, but it's an airplane, you know, kind of.
Yeah.
And I decided, you know, and that's really not the way I need to be traveling these days. It was a nice experience, but I wouldn't necessarily want to do that again. So if I'm going to take a reasonably decent flight, which is difficult to do because of the way the airlines have aligned with one another. So I can get a flight with Lufthansa, for example, who doesn't have a bad reputation. They're usually a little more expensive, but I'll end up on a Delta flight with an American crew. And so then you get treated like another, you know, customer.
You know, I just thought of this, Ed, and I wish I'd thought of it when it mattered. You know, my son is in improv comedy.
You had mentioned that he was taking a
European. And he did a European tour, and he was in Berlin and Munich.
Yeah. They are equally far away, but if I had known, I would have seen if I could have arranged to.
Yeah, that would have been
a trip.
Well, and so he's scheduled to fly back from Munich, you know, and they had planned all the logistics out, and the flight was canceled back to the States here.
Oh, and really?
He started just to have a meltdown. I mean, he did the tour. They went to Iceland, England, and then Germany.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was just this amazing logistical
feat. Yeah.
And meeting all these people. And then he's all ready to come home, you know.
Yeah, I believe it.
The flight was canceled.
And he was I know how. Yeah, I can understand. I've taken short trips for the projects I used to work on my last employer. And since we always had to take the cheapest flights anywhere, that meant taking the first flight out in the morning and the last flight out at night. And if there are any flights that ever get canceled, it's the last one at night. Mm. And I spent more than an extra night in Poland more than once. So well, I know you exactly. Were ready to go home, you know, but...
You were military back when I was military with my family. We used to fly Space Available.
Space Available.
Ring a bell?
Yeah. You can't even do that. I remember that. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You go there and take your chances.
You take your chances. And that's the way, oddly enough, a lot of airlines employees have to fly these days. They can book flights. And they can book seats, but they don't always get them, you know. So they're always playing a little bit of an iffy game when we get there. My other son-in-law's parents both worked for British Airways. So when they come from Colombia to visit, it's always a little bit iffy that they make the plane and make it over kind of thing. The Space Available was a real trippy way to fly. Anybody could do it, you know. And if you had time on your hands, it was a very reasonable way to fly, you know, if you weren't under pressure.
Well, flying used to be fun.
Yeah, and it's not anymore. So
it isn't.
Hey guys, I'm gonna go because it's 1 o'clock.
Okay, Michael.
Nice seeing you guys. See you in the next cafe. Bye bye.
Yeah. Can't be more than a week away.
Is that it? Well, okay. Yeah. I guess we'll just wrap this up, or I'll start. You know.
Right, we'll get into who knows what, but I just wanted to make sure you were on the up and up there. So glad to see you got to meet Jeffrey. I agree with you 100%. There is nothing that replaces same space communication.
Yeah,
you're getting the same space.
Which all this new stuff, technology, and we talked about it too. It just there's no replacement for it.
No.
It just, no. You know, and all those, you know, it's a vibe. It's a friend or foe. Yeah. It's a vibe. It's a something that's right. Unknowable. You right. Don't know until you're in the same space with somebody.
Exactly. And that's why I don't have any delusions that AI is going to be taking over anytime soon, because I don't know how they're going to manage to do the vibe part. And that is actually essential for the real communication between human beings, is the bond.
I think I'm
firmly convinced of that. So this is nice in when there's nothing else, you know. So there's no alternative.
We're so antisocial that we can only
communicate with everything else.
Yeah, with a half a dozen people who are 6,000 miles away, we can't find somebody right next door.
We say that, but you know, one of the presenters at the conference, Hans Grinich, who kicked it off, I've known him for over 25 years, and we met online, and we only knew each other online for probably 3 years before we met face to face. And he was looking for a grad school, and he was thinking about checking some places out. And I said, well, why don't you, I was living in California at the time. I said, why don't you come out? You can stay at my place. And he said, okay. So he was going to come out, and I was going to pick him up at the airport in San Francisco. And he said, and I said, oh, how I recognize you. And this is typical Hans. He goes, we should just know. And that was it. So I went to the airport. I have no, I didn't know how tall he was, how old he was, how, nothing other than he was looking for a grad school. Okay. But we had shared a lot of things online, so I kind of knew a lot of things about him, you know. And this plane from New York empties into, this is in the days when you can actually go to the gate, you know, where the people came out, that kind of thing. And when he walked through the door, I go, oh, that's Hans. And he comes up and says, hi, Ed, how you doing? Because we were able, based on these other things, you know, you'll appreciate this as a psychologist, you do construct aspects of a person that, and that's the exciting part about meeting them finally face to face, that are either confirmed or refuted based on all of that anticipatory, whatever it is. And you find out that a lot of them, depending on how intense the, you know, the interaction was beforehand, get borne out. You know, so we pick up a lot, but that's not the substitute. It's not the same thing. You know, it's just some kind of an approximation, and you know, we make do with what we have because that's all we have at the time. But it was really interesting, and we get together maybe, you know, every 5 or 10 years. He shows up, or I'm there. Or we happen, you know, our paths happen to cross. Okay, and you know, then we can pick up kind of where we left off. Excuse me, but it's there's no substitute for the real thing in the end. And I think that's the thing we just have to keep in mind.
And also, as a caveat, too much of a good thing.
Yeah, no argument there either.
Which varies, right, it varies, you know.
Yes, it does. It does. It does. Oh, yeah, it does. Everything's variable.
So, good enough. All right, Ed. We'll
all right. Well, you take care, Mark. We'll see you whenever, you know, whenever you're online. I happen to be there, too. All right. Have a good day. You've still got some of it. My day's over.
All right. Good night.
I got it.